Dallas?
Oh.
Payne?
What does it smell like in here?
Payne.
He's not here.
Okay. Dean Johnson's over here. Linda Cohen.
Linda, great.
Maureen Cisneros is right there. And I want to thank them for coming and supporting the university's request. I'll try to be really brief. We have a video disc we'd like to show you, and I'll just make a few brief comments and then a few summary comments so that we can engage in some discussion, because I know you have a full agenda. One of our proud alums, Garrison Keeler, once described the University of Minnesota as one of the glories of our state, and I obviously believe that and feel it in my very soul. And talk about it each and every day. We have five campuses, more than 30 locations, research and outreach centers across the state of Minnesota, regional extension offices. And many people, when they think about the university, think about the Twin Cities campus, but we are clearly much more than that, with a presence throughout the state of Minnesota. And I proudly believe that the sum total of the University of Minnesota, its statewide presence, the people who work in all of these different places have a tremendous impact in growing Minnesota's economy and ensuring that we all share an outstanding quality of life. These locations serve more than 100,000 people on an average daily basis. Their faculty, staff, students, guests. It's home, the University of Minnesota is home to more than $600 million in outside funding to support pioneering research in a wide range of fields, and our outreach activities serve more than 1 million Minnesotans on an annual basis. One of the great rewards that I have, and I'm going to have this opportunity again later this evening and tomorrow, is to travel throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm on my way to Marshall. It's an opportunity that I relish to tell the story of the university and to talk to Minnesotans about their concerns. And I'm always amazed at the depth of feeling that people have anywhere in the state, whether it's in an apple orchard or before a Rotary Club, the depth of feeling they have and the pride they have in their own local colleges and universities and also in their University of Minnesota. This is nothing new. Our founding fathers and mothers, just 2 years after we were declared a territory in 1851, established the University of Minnesota, 7 years before we became a state. And I find that to be an inspiring aspect of Minnesota's history. That is that pioneers who came here during that period felt that one of the most important investments they could possibly make was an investment in education, the learning of our fellow citizens, and the development of a great university. Governor John Sargent Pillsbury, often referred to as the father of the University of Minnesota, once said, "There's no factor that can do more for the state and the nation than the University of Minnesota, with its wide open doors ever welcoming all to enter." I think Governor Pillsbury's vision was outstanding in his time, and it's still relevant today. This is a community that's truly, as we characterize it, driven to discover, a community committed deeply to innovation in everything we do, a community deeply committed to changing our state and our world for the better. We do that by advancing knowledge, seeking the truth, sharing that knowledge through education and the engagement that we have in our very diverse society, and applying that knowledge, the knowledge we create, and we synthesize and apply to real-world problems that we think are a service to creating an even greater public good. All of you know that the University of Minnesota has embarked on a very serious transformational process. We think the university, as good as it is, can be much better in the future. This is a very ambitious quest. We think we're making progress. But I want to say again before this committee to beg your indulgence one more time and say we can't do it without you. We really need the state as our partner, and we need strong, predictable, and continuous investment for all of us to succeed. We can't, in short, succeed without strong financial support. The capital request we bring before you is built obviously on a painstaking planning process. It's built on our historic strengths. It's built on the investments you have made in us in the past. But it also addresses what we think are some very important gaps and weaknesses in the university's core infrastructure. The university has some of the oldest and most historic buildings in the state of Minnesota. We have more than 800 of them, covering nearly 28 million assignable square feet of space throughout the state. The Twin Cities campus alone has 250 buildings, and about 25% of those buildings are 70 years or older. I believe we have an obligation to protect this critical part of the state's infrastructure, to preserve and protect these valuable resources that would really be very, very costly to replace, and to do so in a way that enhances and supports the university's vital mission in research, education, and public engagement. And as I said before, this investment, the investment you make in us, is a very critical part of our long-range success. The point I want to make is these are not isolated, disconnected projects. They're part of a 6 to 12-year capital discipline, capital planning process. We think we take a very rigorous approach. Our condition, facilities condition assessment approaches are as rigorous as any you will find in anywhere in the United States. And we think this request addresses serious issues, serious challenges, builds on the past planning we've done, and I think puts us in a position to provide even greater service to the state of Minnesota. Last time I presented the entire request, and some of our younger members, our students and others, felt that was incredibly boring. And so we're going to bring to you a different approach this time, and we're going to present at this time a video presentation that highlights the significant features of our capital request at this time. I'll end then with a few comments, and we'll take your questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Wow, you have so many buildings. How do they take care of them all?
The University of Minnesota has more than 800 buildings across the state, and we have some of the oldest buildings. On the Twin Cities campus alone, there are more than 250 buildings. 25% of them are more than 70 years old. That's a lot to take care of, and we take our stewardship responsibilities very seriously. Vice President O'Brien will explain how we use HEPR funds. That stands for Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement, to maintain our buildings.
Hi, I'm Kathleen O'Brien, the Vice President of University Services. It's my job to make sure that the university buildings support our teaching, research, and outreach. This building, Coffee Hall, is in the 2008 HEPR request. It needs waterproofing and tuck pointing. We're preserving the structural integrity of this 101-year-old building so that it will last another 100 years. Every day I think about creating a safe campus for our students, faculty, and staff, and buildings that are well-maintained, function efficiently, and don't put our people at risk. Like this elevator in a 5-story research building, the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory. That can't be operated without making a special arrangement. And it's a point of pride to me to be able to preserve historic buildings by giving them a new modern purpose while maintaining their historic integrity. Back to the question. We inspect about 7 to 8 million square feet each year on the Twin Cities campus, and from those inspections, we've created a database of the conditions of all of the buildings on the Twin Cities campus. We update this database annually, and we have the same program on all of our other campuses. It's a lot of buildings to keep track of and a lot of money to take care of them. It would cost about $7 billion to replace all the buildings throughout the University of Minnesota. That's why it's important to me and to the state to take care of what we have, and that's what HEPR funds do.
As you've heard from Vice President O'Brien, our buildings provide mission-critical space for our faculty, staff, students, and visitors. Past generations have made investments in the U, and it's our responsibility, in partnership with the state, to maintain the value of those investments for generations to come.
I took chemistry 1001 in this building in 1974.
I took introductory calculus in this building in 1987.
I took geology 1001 in this building in 2005.
I took organic chemistry in this building in 2004.
I took physics in this building in 1985.
I took physical chemistry in this building in 2003.
Why
is this building still here?
The university is the state's premier source of human capital and innovation, which are critical to state economic growth and national competitiveness. Core Minnesota industries, including health, medical devices, technology, and roughly 400 food companies, depend on an educated, scientifically literate workforce, basic and applied research, and new ideas generated here at the university. As a nation, however, we are falling behind. Policymakers and employers are calling for more graduates in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and there's growing consensus that new ways of teaching science are required.
Hi, I'm Mary Koskin, director of the One Stop Student Services Center. I'd like to see this building replaced too. Over the years, we've greatly improved our student services like registration, financial aid, and advising. Most routine transactions can now be completed online, but students and parents often prefer face-to-face conversations with professional counselors and advisors. We'd like to consolidate in-person student services in one location on this site. This location has one of the highest concentrations of pedestrian traffic on campus. We can enhance the student experience by centralizing services in the new Science Teaching and Student Services Center. Services like career counseling, advising for students in transition, and student leadership that are now scattered across campus. The new building will provide an ideal location to serve two major functions: a space for new state-of-the-art classroom facilities for basic science teaching, and a home for a consolidated student services center.
Hi, I'm Robin Wright, Associate Dean in the College of Biological Sciences and Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology, and Development. We envision a new way to teach science at the University of Minnesota. Research shows that student-centered, inquiry-based teaching methods increase student retention in the sciences. These classroom approaches also promote deeper learning and help students develop the critical skills they'll need for successful careers and life as engaged citizens of their communities, state, and nation. After all, scientists work in a collaborative, technology-rich environment, and that's the kind of environment we want to create in a new building, the Science Teaching and Student Services Center. I'm sitting in a prototype of the type of classroom that will be in this new building, a classroom with flexible learning space that supports increased student interactions in a technology-rich, multimedia environment. These new high-tech, high-touch learning spaces will help us provide our students with the up-to-date, high-quality education they must have to thrive in an increasingly competitive, global scientific community.
Northern Minnesota needs more civil engineers. What is the University of Minnesota Duluth going to do for us?
The work of civil engineers is critical to our economy and quality of life. They plan, design, construct, and operate the structures that are essential to modern life. From bridges and highway systems to water treatment plants and energy-efficient buildings, civil engineers enhance the way we live by addressing issues including traffic congestion, urban sprawl, pollution, and sustainability.
Hello, I'm Catherine Martin, Chancellor of the University of Minnesota Duluth. We have recently announced the addition of a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering. This degree has been added in direct response to area industries and public agencies that have expressed a great need for engineers in northeastern Minnesota. The first class will start in the fall of 2008 and will enroll 200 students within 4 years, graduating 35 to 40 civil engineers on an annual basis. Minnesota students, as well as local industries, have expressed a great deal of interest in the necessity of having an additional civil engineering degree in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the state is losing prospective engineering students to other states. We can help prevent this brain drain with our graduates who will provide key skills to support mining and other industries in our region. This building houses mechanical, chemical, and industrial engineering programs. Together, these programs will lead to a more stable and comprehensive foundation for civil engineering programs in northern Minnesota.
UMD's civil engineering program is a natural complement to existing engineering programs. It will contribute to a healthy and viable environment and economy for northern Minnesota. This building addition will ensure that UMD will be able to provide a quality, hands-on education and fill the need for civil engineers for years to come.
As a mayor of Morris, I'm interested in how to keep small towns in rural Minnesota vital. How do I access the University of Minnesota Morris's education, research, and expertise?
Consistently named one of the nation's top public liberal arts colleges, the University of Minnesota Morris is a prime example of our three-part mission: a world-class liberal arts education in a small college environment, groundbreaking research in renewable energy, and award-winning examples of campus community engagement. Chancellor Jacqueline Johnson will tell you more.
My name is Jackie Johnson, and I'm honored to be the Chancellor at the University of Minnesota Morris, part of the vibrant community that is Morris in this west central part of Minnesota. There are so many ways in which the university and the community have partnered. I'm standing here in Big Cat Stadium, which just opened last year and is a partnership between the university and the community. Morris Area High School Tigers and the University of Minnesota Cougars play football in this stadium. Behind me is the Regional Fitness Center, which is an early example of this partnership. The Center for Small Towns at the University of Minnesota Morris is a national example of public engagement. And in fact, we won last year the Carter Community Partnership Award to exemplify the good work that we have done over the last 10 years in creating an alliance between the university and the community. My vision for this campus includes increased enrollment, even stronger partnerships with the community and with the region, and our strategic plan calls on us to be energy self-sufficient by the year 2010. We imagine the existing community services building as a gateway to the campus. We also imagine this building as a home for the Center for Small Towns. We also expect to renovate this building in such a way that we will preserve the past at the same time that we continue to promote the green effects that are part of the developing, distinguishing characteristics of the University of Minnesota Morris.
And that's another way the University of Minnesota Morris is a strong regional partner. The first large-scale wind research turbine ever constructed at a U.S. public university began generating power here in March 2005. It powers half of the campus buildings and returns the excess power to Otter Tail Power Company. And a soon-to-be-completed biomass project will burn agricultural waste from the region, like corn stover, injecting hundreds of thousands of dollars into the local economy, all while conserving energy, reducing greenhouse gases, and creating educational opportunities for students.
Wow! Those dioramas at the Bell Museum were really cool. I wonder what's going to be in the new Bell Museum.
The Bell Museum is Minnesota's official natural history museum. Established by statute in 1872, the Bell Museum collects, preserves, and displays our state's animal and plant life for research, teaching, and public enjoyment. It is one of the country's premier research-based science museums. In fact, the Bell scientific collections were instrumental in saving the peregrine falcon. The Bell is truly a living research museum that serves our community in a very unique way, making the university's work in the biological, environmental, social, and physical sciences come alive for literally thousands of visitors of all ages each year. I'll let our museum director tell you more.
Hi, I'm Scott Lanyon, director of the Bell Museum of Natural History. The university's in the final stages of preparing plans for a new museum facility on the St. Paul campus. The new facility will be the gateway to the St. Paul campus, and visitors will have easy access not only to the Bell Museum, but to the Raptor Center, Equine Center, the Bee Lab, greenhouses, and the Display Garden, all great places to visit. The building we're in now was built in the 1930s. At that time, natural history museums were focused on preserving the past, and the Bell Museum does that as well with its world-famous habitat dioramas. These dioramas will be preserved in the new facility we're building on the St. Paul campus. In the new museum, we'll create interactive displays and exhibits that inspire inquiry and bring people closer to their natural world. Young and old alike can learn from the state's largest collection documenting Minnesota's biodiversity. The new Bell Museum will be an exciting place to visit. It will include indoor and outdoor exhibit space, gallery space for traveling exhibits and dioramas, an auditorium, and classroom and community space. The 12-acre site will be landscaped to represent Minnesota's three ecosystems, prairie, Northwoods coniferous forest, and maple basswood deciduous forest, and will contain interactive exhibits. The building and landscape will be designed to attract wildlife and will include trails, ponds, observation posts, and a range of nesting sites. And will incorporate sustainable building design in the new building. We've already done some planning in this end. In fact, we won the highly competitive Kresge Foundation Green Building Grant to develop these plans. It's exciting to look forward to that first day in the new building, when we can continue the museum's decades-long tradition of educating Minnesota's teachers, students, and indeed anyone with a thirst to learn about the natural world.
¿De qué forma la universidad está preparando a los estudiantes para la economía global?
Falwell Hall, in the historic Knoll District of the Minneapolis campus, is 100 years old. It was named for William Watts Falwell, the first president of the university at a time when the university had 8 faculty and fewer than 100 students. Falwell envisioned the university as a cultural center of the state, and today, his namesake building is home to nearly 300 instructional staff and more than 1,000 majors in its 5 departments in the College of Liberal Arts. I'll let some of our faculty tell you more.
Hi, I'm Laura Gurak, a professor and chair of the Department of Writing Studies at the university. This new department was created as a result of strategic positioning, a long-term plan for the University of Minnesota to become one of the top public research universities in the world. A commitment to exceptional education is a cornerstone of this plan, and the ability to write is central to a quality education. Our goal is for every university graduate in every major to be able to write in a logical, understandable way. It's what we want, and it's what employers want for our graduates. The university-wide baccalaureate writing initiative will be housed in a renovated Falwell Hall. Every single undergraduate on the Twin Cities campus, nearly 29,000 students, will use this building. Every freshman will be required to take writing. So it's vital that we renovate this building and its learning environments to be flexible, adaptable, and up to university standards in order to provide the best education we can for our students.
Hi, I'm Ana Paula Ferreira, a professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese Studies. I'm standing in the Language Center of Jones Hall, renovated in 2005. This center has all the latest instructional technology and resources to assist faculty and students in second language teaching and learning. Falwell Hall is right next door, and my department will be housed there along with many other language departments. Language instruction is increasingly important in today's world, and the university is utilizing new techniques to ensure our graduates have the language skills and cultural literacy to be successful. New classrooms in Falwell Hall will allow us to better prepare our students for a rapidly globalizing world. More than 30 languages are taught at the university, 19 in Falwell Hall alone. We envision Falwell Hall becoming a multilingual and multicultural hub for students, with space that supports and enhances learning rather than what we have today. After all, language and writing are essential in a global economy.
Our vision for Falwell Hall befits its namesake, an historic signature building that serves students and the state by educating global citizens with effective communication skills across disciplines and cultures.
How does the university's request for buildings improve my education?
The quality of the education students receive at the U is of utmost importance to all of us and is directly affected by the learning environment. The university has about 300 general-purpose classrooms used for teaching in many different disciplines. These classrooms are spread across 55 buildings on the Twin Cities campus and accommodate 22,000 students each hour of the class day. For several years, the university has been upgrading classrooms with the latest technology and improved facilities. These upgrades are essential in providing the quality teaching and learning environment that faculty and students need.
Hi, I'm Gary Ballas, a professor in aerospace engineering mechanics at the U. My department is housed in Ackerman Hall. The classroom I'm standing in is outdated and inflexible. As you can see, the windows are single pane, there's poor lighting, uneven heating, and no ventilation. And it's not handicap accessible. This classroom is one of nine that would be renovated in this building. Their biggest limitation is that they are poor learning spaces that are lacking in technology and physical attributes that we need in today's active learning classrooms. We're not meeting the needs of faculty or the expectations of students as we prepare them to work and conduct research in a collaborative, technology-rich environment. It's our goal to provide students the highest quality education at the University of Minnesota. To do that, our classrooms need to keep pace with the dynamic teaching and learning needs of faculty and students. By investing in classrooms, we are investing in our students and our future.
It's important to know that it has taken us a number of years to get where we are today. Classroom improvement is a hallmark of good stewardship at the university.
What's the university doing to stay competitive in research?
Hi, I'm Tim Mulcahy, Vice President for Research. The University of Minnesota is one of the nation's premier public research universities. In 2006, our faculty brought in $570 million in research grants and contracts, and we expect that number to be more than $600 million in 2007. We've been credited with four of the world's top academic innovations with real-world applications, including treatments for HIV, purifying water supplies for the developing world, treating equine metabolic disorders, and preventing swine pandemics, which would be catastrophic to the state's pork industry. Great research depends on world-class researchers. In order for the university to recruit and retain the world's best, we need to be able to offer them facilities like this in which to do their work. New facilities like these in the Cargill building are typical of the quality needed everywhere. With new buildings like this, we have been successful in recruiting world-class researchers at the cutting and competitive edge of their fields. We've also been able to retain many researchers who otherwise would have been lured away by offers including great facilities elsewhere. Some of our faculty, however, struggled to maintain research programs in old buildings, like Calfert Lab, built in 1958 to 1958 research standards. Such antiquated facilities make it difficult to compete in an increasingly competitive research environment. Many old laboratories need utility upgrades to handle modern instrumentation. Some require renovations to accommodate changes in federal research regulations, while still others need installation of new biological containment systems and rebuilt ventilation systems. All are modern research necessities. Much like our approach in updating classrooms throughout our campuses, we need to make targeted strategic investments to improve facilities to support research in areas like food and nutrition, veterinary medicine, health sciences, and engineering. Modern laboratories make all the difference in our ability to attract the best and brightest faculty and students. Through the resulting increase in competitiveness and productivity, structured investments in our research infrastructure will pay dividends for years and generations to come.
I know what teaching is, and I know what research is, but how does the university do outreach?
The University of Minnesota faculty and staff connect to the community in so many ways and in so many locations. Partnerships with school districts, regional extension offices, and the Landscape Arboretum, to name just a few. The university's six research and outreach centers are set up to respond to regional needs, to bring university research to bear in achieving practical solutions for specific community needs. each center forges strong partnerships and works to connect local communities to the university's expertise.
I'm Larry Smith. I'm the head of the Northwest Research and Outreach Center located in Crookston, Minnesota. The focus of our center is agricultural research and outreach. More than 50 researchers lead hundreds of research projects relevant to Northwest Minnesota, like sugar beets where we are now and wheat research. Northwest Minnesota has the largest gross farm income from crop production of anywhere in the state. The center is well connected to area farmers and provides them with the research and education they need in their day-to-day operations. The research center also serves as a training ground for students in agricultural programs at the University of Minnesota Crookston. Our research and educational programs are intimately connected to the economic vitality of this great region of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Al Levine, Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences. Agriculture in Minnesota is diverse, and the West Central Research and Outreach Center responds to this diversity by addressing issues related to the broad range of agricultural systems in the region, like livestock raising and swine production, and the environmental impact of those activities, like water quality. Working with farmers, rural leaders, and citizens, we stay connected to the varied and changing needs of the producers and citizens of Minnesota. Working together in partnership is our greatest strength. The West Central Research and Outreach Center also houses the Hughes Renewable Energy Research and Demonstration Center. Research is focused on wind, biomass, biofuels, and renewable hydrogen. It's our goal to provide a model for rural communities and ag producers who want to incorporate renewable energy systems and to inform the state's renewable energy industry. Renewable energy is poised to become an important part of our state and nation's energy future, and the West Central Research and Outreach Center will be a leader in this work.
President Brunigs, before you continue, I just wanted to allow Senator Anderson, who's chairing her own committee, to say a few words about the Bell Museum. She'll just, you can stay where you are. She'll just come and join you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, President Brunix, for giving me just a moment. I apologize for bumping you. My committee is also finalizing our bonding request today, so I do need to get back. So I really appreciate just taking 2 minutes of your time. I wanted to speak in support of the Bell Museum proposal and just give you a couple of key facts, and I know President Brunix and the rest of the presenters will talk about it as well, but this is my bill that I introduced. And it's a project that I am very passionate about as something that I hope we can provide funding for this year in the bonding bill. As you probably all know, the Bell Museum was created in 1872 by legislative mandate as the state's natural history museum. So it's truly a historical and iconic part of our entire state's legacy. And it's functioned for many, many years in several different locations, but I'm sure many of you have been to the current site on the East Bank, and it's really outgrown that site. Obviously, the Bell Museum has a huge educational component, not just for undergraduate and graduate students, but for K-12 students around the state, and it does outreach to all 87 counties. So it affects the entire state in a lot of different ways through education and outreach, and also as the role that it plays and will play in this new facility is so critically important. So I just want to comment on my committee, the Environment and Energy and Natural Resources Committee, has spent a lot of time this session in looking at all of our budget requests in talking about the need that we have as a state to try to inspire a connection to the natural world, the outdoors, and the natural resources that we treasure in Minnesota. And we're all really concerned about declining rates of participation in outdoor activities, in visiting to our parks, and about the connection that young people have to the outdoors. One of the wonderful things about this proposal is that it will create a really accessible way for all Minnesotans to be able to experience that and to enhance their connection to the outdoors. The outdoor portion of this project is the $4 million request that the DNR has to develop the landscape and the outdoor portion, and that my committee is enthusiastically supporting in our bonding recommendations to Senator Langseth. So that's a separate appropriation. And that would be an outdoor area that would reflect and represent the three different major biomes of Minnesota on a small scale, so that you can run around and experience those and sort of, you know, get a taste for what we have to offer across our whole state. And the building itself is also going to be LEED Gold certified and a very green building that will combine our natural resources with our environmental ethics in Minnesota. So it's a really, really exciting project. The last thing I'll mention is the budget request for the university side is $24 million, and there's a great deal of private money that's already been raised to get to the $12 million matching goal. Now, President Brunix, I hope I've left you something to say about this, because I know that you've been very eloquent in your support for this. It's really a legacy project for the University of Minnesota that will serve future generations for many, many years to come. So just wanted to tell you of my enthusiastic support. And I represent the city of Falcon Heights. The city, of course, is very committed and excited to this project at the corner of Cleveland and Larpinder. And it will be across from the Gibbs Museum as well as close to the Raptor Center. So it's a great location in a lot of different ways, but would provide a lot of opportunities.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Anderson. We'll let you get back to your committee.
Good luck. President. Oh, and by the way, I support the university's whole bonding request. So you have a really hard job. Good luck.
That was my next line.
Chair
Pappas, members of the committee, I deeply appreciate Senator Anderson dropping by to give that very passionate plea for the Bell Museum. I think it is a state treasure. I'm obviously a very, very strong advocate. Three presidents have told more than 50 donors, if they went out and raised money for the one-third debt, that this would end up on the university's list. That probably is a good reason to put it on the list. They've mostly accomplished their task, and I think if the state supports this bill, we'll raise the rest of the private money in rather short order. Several foundations have indicated an interest in working with us. But I would also say this is more than just a museum. This is a place where we have 35 to 40 of our classes, where pioneering research is done related to animals and our natural environment. It's a place where literally tens of thousands of students at all age levels come to visit each and every year. The St. Paul campus will be increasingly a center of great research and application in renewable energy and the environment. Our Institute for the Environment is there. Our Institute on Renewable Energy is there. The Raptor Center is there. Obviously, the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences is there. We think this is a really excellent project. Someone asked me the other day what will happen to the old Bell Museum. That will be repurposed for the College of Design, and we'll have the opportunity to bring some units in the College of Design from St. Paul to Minneapolis and then move some vitally important units that are related to the long-term vision of the St. Paul campus the other way. You have before you the summary of the budget. The total capital request is $288 million, roughly. We're asking the state for approximately $225 million. The university would fund approximately $63 million of that with the one-third debt requirement. We think it's a very, very sound request. I do urge you to consider it very, very carefully, and I know you will. You have in the past. I think this is not only a sound request, I think it is a very strong investment in the future of the University of Minnesota, and I would argue in the infrastructure of the state of Minnesota. I just want to end. I know you have so many things on your plate, so many competing requests, and it's very difficult to sort this out, but I think this is a time for Minnesota to stretch. We will not see interest rates like this again for some time. This is a time when we have a soft economy, high unemployment. If there was ever a time to sort of reach down deeply and do the things that I think Minnesota is going to need to do in transportation, in our public infrastructure, I think this is the time to do it. So I would urge you to stretch as far as you can in considering this request, considering the request of my colleagues from Minsky, in looking after the state's long-term needs. I'd be happy to, along with my colleagues, to take your comments and questions at this time.
Thank you, President Brunix. Are there any questions? Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, thank you for your presentation on the capital requests. Mine is a little different question, but I don't get to have you here every day. And last year we increased the state's appropriation to the university by 13%. And I was concerned when I just recently read that it appeared that your tuition increase for next year was going to be at least 7%. And I am kind of looking for the reasons that it would be going up that much after a 13% increase in appropriations, and my concern that we really do want to keep the university affordable. I think that's what parents in Minnesota want. We know we have a good university, and many of them want their children to be able to attend there, and those children want to attend there. And I'm concerned about rising costs and increases that are above the typical inflation rate.
President Brunix.
Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to answer this question. I think it's one of the questions that many people are asking today. Inflation is not tied to the CPI for MinSCU or the University of Minnesota for a whole lot of reasons. CPI doesn't even include people, and 70% of our budget is tied to people. We invest in some of the highest cost laboratories and teaching facilities that you'll find anywhere in the world. So the CPI for higher education has been running over the last 10 to 15 years closer to 4.5%. And that's one point I would make. Second point I would make is that when the university came forward and modeled its request, it modeled approximately 4.5% a year in tuition increases, assuming the state would fully fund the university. The state was generous. I would agree with you in funding the university and in funding MinSCU this last time around. I would remind the committee that not too long ago, we took the largest hit in the state budget, 15% base reduction, $185 million cut. The largest such cut that I could find anywhere in the United States. We weathered that by being creative. Unfortunately, we had to raise prices on students. But a part of this increase is due to the fact that we were not fully funded, but it also occurs on the heels of some what I consider to be devastating impacts that we simply have to address if we're going to keep the quality and the responsiveness of the university at the appropriate level. Now, let me say one other thing. I'm a first-generation college student. I get up every day thinking about this. I think it's my obligation, along with the university community, to do everything in the world to hold down the cost of education for students. And you can be sure that this university community is going to do everything possible to maintain it. The tuition increase this year includes a free tuition component for low-income students who are Pell eligible. 12% of the university students will have no increases whatsoever in their tuition and actually will have their tuition paid. There's also a middle income benefit that allows us to buy down the cost of this increase to about 4.8%. So for a very, very significant, and that was awarded by the legislature in the conference committee last year. So for a very, very large number of students, that cost is going to be lower. And let me say one other thing. We have made private fundraising and support for our students the highest possible priority in the last few years. We started something called the Promise for Tomorrow Scholarship Initiative. We agreed to match the payout of gifts of $25,000 or more. We have more than doubled scholarships for students during this 3.5-year period. The average awards are pretty much about 50% of our students get some direct grant or a scholarship award assistance, and the awards are approaching about $4,000. So when you look at the cost increases for students, I think you have to also look at the scholarship efforts, the reallocation of existing university money, the generous support of the state in buying down tuition for middle-income families with adjusted family incomes of about $150,000 or less, and the total effort that we're doing to really hold down costs and restrain the growth of these costs on our students. But it is a big problem. If we as a country want our students to get the very best education that I think they deserve and our nation and our state absolutely need, we're going to have to invest. We're going to have to do our part as colleges and universities to hold down costs, and I can give you a much longer description of what we're doing to be much more cost-conscious and very disciplined in that process. But there is no cheap way, in my judgment, to the future. If you care about human capital, the role of the of our state in the global economy, we're simply going to have to invest. And we all need to do our part. Private donors, people who have graduated from the University of Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, the university, through being prudent stewards of the state's resources, we all have an obligation. But I've got to tell you, if I back off this 7.5% tuition increase, that will not fall that way on all the students of the university for reasons that I've indicated. I have to make a decision also to recommend to the board that they seriously cut budgets that are already strained and erode the quality of education that we're committed to provide our students, and I simply can't do that, and I won't do it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I guess one of my concerns is that you cited a number of ways that students can get financial aid and help, and that the increase from probably the majority is not going to be 7.5%. But the headlines scream 7.5%. And it scares people away from your institution. Right. And so I don't know, you know, if you are intent on doing this, how you can get the message out that you are still affordable to an average middle-income family. Yeah. And I don't know that message is going out very well, because I think people see those headlines and they're just like, what are we ever going to do? We'll never be able to send our kids to that university, which is our home university.
Yeah. Senator Pappas, right. Senator Roebling, I think you have nailed what one of the big issues are. One of the big issues that we need to face as a community, including as a university. Mark Twain once remarked, and I'm paraphrasing it, that a lie can travel around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. And that's a lot of what we have when we talk about the cost of higher education today. It is the single best investment a young person and a working adult can make in his or her future. But I've offered to the newspapers and the media to actually accept the outsourcing of headlines. I'd be very happy to take that responsibility on for them. We have no control over them, and I agree with you. These headlines are misleading. They're scary. They're not even truthful in terms of what's going on to protect our students from net cost increases. And I think you're right. We have a tremendous educational job. It's one of the reasons why the Higher Education Advisory Committee that I chair this year and Chancellor McCormick chaired last year is making the education of the public the highest possible priority, along with our Office of Higher Education under Susan Hegard. We think we have an educational job to do in this area. We also have to help our students find their way to many of the sources of support that are out there, and that's another thing that we plan to make a really high priority. I think there's no substitute for being prudent in the use of resources and having disciplined cost control. There's no substitute for being entrepreneurial and going out there and raising money that I think our students deserve and in the way of support. And there's no substitute for the state being a consistent and reliable partner in this process. Together, if we do those things, I think we can restrain the growth of these costs for students. But if you look at the trend lines in the last 25, 30 years, and particularly in the last six in the state of Minnesota, there is no question that a lot of these increases in tuition are a direct result of withdrawing public investment and public support. We can have an argument about whether that's wise or useful, but I can tell you as an educator, first-generation college student who worked his way through college and university education through graduate school, there is nothing about raising tuition that gives me any pleasure. And that's true for the university's Board of Regents. We agonize over these decisions. And I basically think we need a really strong public discussion of these issues, and I welcome it over the next several years. I think there are a lot of creative solutions here, but steadfast, reliable support of the state, I think, should be at the top of the list.
President Brunix, I see that you've passed out a flyer on the biomedical research program.
Yes.
Senator Cohen has introduced legislation on that, and unfortunately, we're out of time to discuss that now. So if Dr. Sarah would be willing to come back when we hear Senator Cohen's bill, I think that might be the time to discuss it. Thank you so much.
Good. I'm really sorry if we
And we'll let you go to Marshall. And
all right.
Thank you very much for being here this morning, this afternoon.
We'll be delighted to come back and talk about the biomedical program. We'll look forward to it.
Senator Cohen?
And I feel passionate about that bill, as does Senator Anderson about her bill. So.
Good. We like passion. Thank you very much. Next, yeah. Oh, yes. We do have a student, Ingrid Hoffman, who wanted to comment on the university's bonding proposal. And if her interpreter is here, where is Ingrid?
Am I on here?
Maybe she could do that while you're disconnecting the PowerPoint. Ms. Hoffman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Pappas, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to come here today and have this opportunity to speak with you. As a disabled faculty and student member of the University of Minnesota, specifically I am involved with foreign language departments throughout the University of Minnesota, and I fully am in support of the university bonding bill, and specifically for the renovation of Falwell Hall. I do cross-cultural research, and also currently I'm learning my 25th and 26th language. So as a disabled individual instructor and a student as well, I have a unique perspective, that of the needs for the renovation at Falwell Hall. And because of the lack of technology, using PowerPoints, for example, and just that type of technology need, there is that need for the renovation. And the foreign language students as well, they are limited. And disabled students as well tend to be limited in their access and understanding of the foreign language classes. And I obviously can learn the language that is being taught, but I can't fully understand the instructor and what's being presented in front of the classroom and written while the teacher is writing on the board. And also, the heating and air conditioning situation in Falwell Hall is a very much of a problem right now. There's an instructor within the building, as an instructor. The building, how shall I say, the heating is so hot, the heat is so hot, you have to turn on the air conditioning in the window. But that also then requires, the students then cannot hear what is being said in the classroom because of that noise, and it's completely impossible. So obviously, for the foreign language students, that is a problem, and it's very important to be able to have to understand. So what we do is we turn off if we turn off the air conditioning, then there really is no other option. So basically, there's a couple of choices. You can learn or have your air conditioning on. And another access issue is the elevator. It's very old elevator that is in this building, and oftentimes it is broken down. So we do require, then students have several times had, I've had to crawl up the stairs in order to get up to a specific floor to get to the classroom. And that is one and there is the only accessible spaces in the elevator. That's one space elevator as well. And also, the restrooms are not accessible for handicapped individuals. If you had a wheelchair, the stools are not big enough for a wheelchair to get access to the bathroom. So again, please consider supporting the University Bonding Bill. And thank you. And specifically for Falwell Hall. And thank you for your listening today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hoffman. A number of members of the committee were there on Tuesday. Others were there earlier with the bonding committee, and we very much saw what you described. So thank you. We'll do our best.
And also, can I add a small comment? The Capitol here as well, the Capitol building, is also not accessible. And today, actually, when I arrived at the Capitol, I had to crawl up to the front steps because the handicapped accessible entrance was not deaf accessible. Just to let you know.
So when you push the button, you couldn't talk to anyone. Right. They wouldn't let you in.
Exactly. Right. So that required them to, I get to crawl up to the front door and let them know I was here. And then I had to crawl back down the front steps as well.
I'm very sorry.
Just letting you know what happened this morning.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomassoni.
Chair. Ingrid, you sign in 25 or 26 languages, or you sign and write in 25 or 26 languages?
Eight are sign languages, and the rest are all spoken languages that I have learned.
Spoken.
I grew up in Europe and in different countries in Europe, so I can lip read and read and write those languages and speak them as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Then I'd like to invite the Chancellor, Chancellor McCormick, to come to the table and proceed with your presentation. Because our session here is being shortened, we have to be back on the floor in 2:30. We may not get to hear from Ms. Hegard or Senator Quigley's bill. We'd carry those over till next Tuesday. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Pappas and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim McCormick, and I have the privilege of serving as the Chancellor of the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. And here at the table with me is Trustee Clarence Hightower. Trustee Hightower is the Chair of Finance, Facilities, and Technology Committee of the Board. And I also want to acknowledge the fact that several of our presidents made an effort to be here today. Kevin Kopischke of Alexandria Tech. Maybe
can
just
you raise your hand?
And
Chris Kevin. Okay.
Patrick Johns of Anoka Ramsey. And Cheryl Frank of Inverhills, and Bill Lowe of Metropolitan State University, and Roland Barden of Minnesota State University Moorhead, and Donovan Swichtenberg of St. Paul College. Thank you for coming. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with the committee today about our capital budget request, which is summarized in the publication, Building a Smarter Minnesota, 382,000 Reasons, and details of the publication. And the 382,000 reasons to reinvest, of course, are our 382,000 students we serve each year, 243,000 in credit courses, and an additional 139,000 in non-credit courses, mainly customized job training. Now, for the benefit of the committee, I would like to begin by giving a brief overview of the Minnesota State College and University System. We are a diverse network of 32 colleges and universities committed to meeting the needs of the people of Minnesota. We are the largest provider of higher education in the state, providing access to higher educational opportunity on 53 campuses in 46 Minnesota communities. And I would like to remind you just a word about our vision that the board sharpened in this last year, because it's the core that guides our strategic plan and other things, and that is that these colleges and universities that are part of the system will enable is a very important word, enable the people of Minnesota. And the people, we mean all of the citizens of Minnesota, the new immigrants, the people of Minnesota, to succeed by providing the most accessible and highest valued education in the nation. In a very real sense, we educate Minnesota. We make it work. Our colleges and universities produce more than half of the state's new teaching graduates, 80% of the new nursing graduates, 92% of the state's law enforcement officers. We also produce 91% of the new construction trades graduates, and every year we provide training to 9,000 firefighters and emergency first responders. Many of the projects on our list directly address those needs. In all, we serve 64% of Minnesota's undergraduates, nearly three times as many as the private colleges serve, and more than four times as many as the University of Minnesota. I know that some of you are interested in the number of students taking courses in science, technology, and math, effectively known as STEM, and more than 111,000 students per year take STEM courses, and we're increasing those numbers. We also serve more students of color than any other system, about 32,900 in 2007. Students of color now make up 14.8% of the student body. Now, our enrollment has been healthy. Our full-year equivalent enrollment is now at an all-time high. Now, to serve these students and provide them with high-quality educational services, we need a well-maintained and up-to-date educational facility operation. Our request is for $350 million for 37 capital projects located throughout the state. Now, this amount, user financing, will cover $77 million, leaving a general obligation bond financing request of $273 million. Every state college and university in the system will benefit from these projects, which will improve learning spaces and services to students. Now, Madam Chair, I would like to make a point that will be crucial in your deliberations concerning the overall amounts that are in the governor's request. As acknowledged in his proposal, his recommendation for us includes one-third debt service payment by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. So to compare apples to apples, the governor has recommended $99.4 million in general obligation bond financing for us, with our user financing of about $29 million paid by the system and the students. It brings us to $128 million. Now I would like to ask Trustee Hightower to describe the board's role in developing the capital request.
Thank you, Chancellor. For the record, my name is Clarence Hightower, and I serve as the chair of the board's Finance, Facilities, and Technology Committee. Madam Chair and members, the Board of Trustees believe that the request we are presenting today is an investment in the future of our state. We take very seriously our responsibility to be good stewards of our existing assets and to protect the previous investments made by state taxpayers. This request is the culmination of a very thoughtful and strategic process that began more than 18 months ago. It is grounded on the system strategic plan adopted in 2006. We used the plan's four strategic directions as guidelines by which to evaluate proposals that came forward. Like the legislature, our board received more proposals than we are able to handle. Requests for 91 capital projects and 300 HEPA projects for a total of $609 million were submitted by the colleges and universities. We worked with advice from technical reviewers to narrow the list down to the most critical projects. The result is the final capital budget request that's before you today. This request also represents a green and sustainable approach to facilities planning, construction, and operations. Of our 37 projects, 28 include some amount of reuse and renovation. 14 of the projects are 100% renovation. We also plan to use recycled and renewable products where we can, use materials that maintain a healthy indoor environment, and use electrical and mechanical devices that save energy and conserve water. Unless there's additional questions, I'll turn it back to the
Mr. Chancellor. Hightower, of that $600 million in requests, how much of that was for HEPR? Are you recommending all the HEPR requests?
No, it was about $300 million of that was for HEPR.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed. Okay, thank you, Trustee Hightower. Madam Chair and members, I want you to know that this board took a very active role in shaping the list of projects. They attended public hearings and they asked good, tough questions. In a moment, I will be turning the presentation over to Associate Vice Chancellor Alan Johnson, who will give you very briefly some of the details. We'll give you the details of the projects on our list. But first, I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for the time you spent looking at these projects. I know you have visited a number of the campuses with their proposed projects all over the state, and I know that your presence was greatly appreciated by our students and our faculty and staff. In all this year, our campuses hosted 85 visits from the committees or individual legislators, and we really thank you for making that effort to look firsthand at the things that we're doing and the things that we need. I've also visited every campus with a major project and with major HEPR projects, too, but I thank you again. Madam Chairman, I would like to turn the presentation over to Al Johnson, and then, with your permission, several representatives of faculty and student associations would like to address the committee. They are Karen Rockett, representing the Minnesota State University Student Association, Scott Formo, president of the Minnesota State College a Student Association, Dr. Nancy Black, president of the Inter-Faculty Organization, representing our state university faculty, Shahzad Ahmad, president of the Minnesota State University University of Administrator and Service Faculty, and Karen Foreman, who will be representing AFSCME. Unless the committee has questions this time, this will complete my remarks, but I'll be here for questions as the progress goes forward.
Are there any questions for the Chancellor? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Johnson. Are we going to Mr. Johnson or are we going to the
We'd go to
panel?
We'd
Mr. Johnson, okay.
I think, Gal, would we go to them now? Or?
Madam Chair, good afternoon, members. For the record, I'm Alan Johnson, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'd like to continue a few of the themes that you heard from Chancellor McCormick and Trustee Hightower as we developed our capital budget this year. Some of the highlights from our capital budget guidelines are shown here, some of the academic imperatives. I'd like to also stress that, as the Chancellor mentioned, that 25 of our projects touch directly on science, technology, engineering, and math, and 15 of the projects are also at centers of excellence. We also take seriously our responsibility for sustainability and taking care of existing buildings. You've heard that 28 projects are renovation. We also have within the projects that 30 of these major renovation projects will go and reduce the backlog. And you've heard a lot about the backlog as you've traveled around to our campuses. So almost $60 million embedded in the individual renovation projects, about $60 million will go directly for taking care of some of our backlog. Well, I'll mention a little bit about that in a few moments as well. Our design standards go right to the heart of maintaining a high quality and energy efficient buildings in our construction as well as our renovation. And we try to integrate sustainability not only into our facilities planning and design, but into the operational aspects of our campuses. This is the governor's recommendations and how it stacks up. And you see the column there of our request totals $350 million, less the user financing that the Chancellor mentioned, or $272 million. The governor has recommended a total of $128 million, less financing, or a net amount of $99 million. while we're pleased that the governor supported the list, with the exception of skipping over number 8 and including number 9, the system-wide science lab initiative for renovation, we're concerned over the reduced funding in HEPR and the fact that many projects, beginning with number 10 on the list, many projects were supported by the legislature in the last two bonding cycles and are not included in the governor's list. And many of those projects are ready to go. And as the chancellor mentioned, it's important to note that after the user financing is deducted, and that user financing, again, is paid for by the system and paid for by the, each individual college and university, that after that is deducted, the net amount is $99 million. That's the GO bond financing amount, and it's that number that you should be using to compare our request with those of others. We've taken some criticism this year for the amount of our capital request at $350 million, but if you look at it over the past 10 years, you'll see that it's kept up pretty closely with construction inflation going back to 1998. Some of the principles that we incorporate as we put our capital budget together is to finish the projects that you've already funded and that have already started. 16 projects were funded for design in past biennia. We have, of those projects, we have $155 million of those projects and HEPR projects that are ready for contract in the next 12 months. So by this time next year, fully funding of our list, we would have $155 million under contract and underway. We want to bring on new projects, either through design or a small amount of design, a small amount of construction and design, and 14 projects at the lower portion of the list reflect that principle. And once again, renovation versus new construction. If you look at the amount of square footage that our budget touches upon in 2008 and 10, the phasing of projects into 10, you can see that by far almost 70% there goes towards renovation of existing space. Another way to look at it is how the budget is spread around what I call the core of our teaching and learning, or the meat and potatoes of our higher education mission. And you can see that 38% of the budget goes directly to classrooms, 31% to science labs, 9% to applied labs, and primarily technical colleges, and 10% in our two law enforcement projects. Our budget is also balanced regionally. If you look at the upper left-hand pie chart, it shows you where the students are. And 34% of our students are in the metro area, and the balance in greater Minnesota. If you look then to the lower left, just below that, that pie chart shows where the capital budget is allocated this year. 37% in the metro area, a lot of that due to the growth of enrollment in the metro area. But I think what's important is to look at it over the period 1998 through 2010, which is in the lower right-hand corner pie chart, which shows you that the balance, the appropriations that that you have and that we hope you will award to us balances out where we are appropriating funds about 34% in the metro area, which matches the student enrollment very closely. HEPR is about 30% metro area and about 70% outstate on the 110 list, on a $110 million list. This definition of HEPR you've seen before many times that I've been up here, and it's fundamental, very important need to maintaining the quality of our educational environment for major repairs, replacement, and renewal of existing spaces. The $110 million that we've requested for the past several biennium, this year, looking at the HEPR request in conjunction with the major renovation request, we could reduce our backlog by 50%, cut it in half over 13 years. And that's one of the reasons why the 110 continues to show up here year over year. Mm-hmm. To your question that you raised before, in 2006, our campus requests for HEPA were $235 million. And in 2008, those requests were up to just a little bit over $300 million. Well, that's all in context with a current backlog around the system of $672 million. And the reason that that level of requests has grown from 06 to 08, I think, first of all, the limited amount of HEPA funding we've received in the past several years, and then the age of our facilities. This chart shows that much of our square footage in that left-hand column, the left-hand axis is millions of square feet. But you see, most of our square footage was built in the 60s and the 70s. And it's time that much of the systems and much of the building components are wearing out and coming due for renewal and replacement. Certainly roofs, some of our roofs are on their second cycle, even some, unfortunately, on their third cycle. We do, of course, have several buildings that date back to the late 1800s and early 1900s, but the bulk of the square footage we're dealing with is in that 38 to 40 years old category.
Mr. Johnson, how many square feet do you have? Do you know off the top of your head of all the buildings?
We have about 26 million square feet. It's about one-third of the state's square footage. The university, President Brunick said 28 million.
28 million, yeah.
26 million, and that includes residence halls and student unions, so it includes the revenue fund.
I was surprised at that because I would have thought that Minsky would have more square feet, more buildings than the University of Minnesota.
No, it works about the same, mm-hmm. about the same. It's, of course, spread over a
right.
A large area, but it's about the same square footage.
Okay.
We allocate HEPA based on a principle of keeping our students, staff, and faculty warm, safe, and dry. And that's one of the first criteria we look at as we look at HEPA projects. We respect college and university priorities that no one knows better the condition of their facilities than the college or university president and their staff. And so we recognize their priorities when projects are submitted. We look at them and test them against the principle of keeping folks warm, safe, and dry, and focus a great deal on roofs, the building envelope, mechanical systems, and so on. Elevators have been a new entry this year. You heard the University of Minnesota mention one of their critical elevators. We have several that have to be brought up to code here in the next several years, and so we have elevators on the list this year. And we also, where we've been successful in moving HEPA projects out, is to reserve a small amount of HEPA every year to advance design for the next biennium. Hmm. This shows how our $110 million list is broken out, about $40 million in heating, ventilating, and air conditioning replacements, about $40 million in roof repairs, and you can see how the other functions are broken out as well. A word about spending HEPA. This is the 2005 spending rate, and there's a couple of interesting things here. First of all, we met our commitment to you, and that was that if you appropriate HEPA dollars, we will spend them. And In the case of 2005, the bill was in March of 2005, and you can see by March of 2007, all HEPA dollars were fully allocated and committed towards contracts, and 33 months after appropriation, December of 2007, all that money was spent. In 2006, HEPA, we're well on the way to meeting that same commitment. That money was available in June of 2006, and we're tracking towards June of 2008. For 100% commitment and then 100% spending in 30 to 33 months. The other interesting thing about this, let me bounce back to the 2005. And you can see that bill came out early. If you remember in 2005, it was basically the 2004 bill that was redone in 2005. and we were able to move that money out and get a lot of work done that summer season. And so by Christmas of 05, by December of 05, almost 60% of that 05 HEPR was committed. Now, while 2006 HEPR is tracking very nicely, you can see that only 35% was committed by December. So getting that money out early gets the summer construction season, and that's an important thing, particularly with respect to roofs. A word on our projects and priorities. I won't spend the time in going over each project. I could refer you, would refer you to our bonding booklet that has each project in its priority and a description of each one. Just as an overview, priority number one, of course, is HEPR, and there is a description of that in the booklet. 2 through 20, I would draw to your attention as those projects that had received prior legislative approval. Through number 20, there was funds appropriated last session, or in 2006, towards either construction or design. A couple of points in there as well. Number 9 and number 14, although you haven't, you didn't see the specific science lab renovations in the past, you've seen that concept, the concept of bringing a project with perhaps 10 to 11 small science lab renovations. In this case, 11 campuses would have one or two science labs renovated at about $500,000 apiece. In the case of number 14 classrooms, at 7 campuses, there would be about $500,000 per campus that would go to specifically to classroom renovations. Again, another concept that has been recognized in past bonding bills. New projects begin with number 21, and right on the inside cover is our total list, so you can refer to that. 21 through 37 represent new projects. Some to highlight for you, number 28 is a property acquisition at 8 campuses. Number 29 is demolition. We want to continue to remove obsolete and worn out and those structures that are not feasible or not economical to keep on the inventory. Number 30 is also a property acquisition. It's has its own line item, and that's for the Owatonna College and University Center. We've been in Owatonna for 25 or 30 years now, I believe, delivering programs in rental space. And at this point, it's clear to us that serving that region, serving that city as a permanent campus makes sense, and this would acquire the building that is currently owned by the city of Owatonna. It would acquire that as a campus center. So once again, I refer you to the booklet. And then finally, there's some language this session that you'll be seeing that I'd like to touch upon briefly. That we're circulating and asking your support for some changes in statute. The first one there, disposition of surplus property. You may recall that the board in statute does have authority to surplus land and to turn that and the proceeds stay at that particular campus. What we'd like to do here is add the word improvements to that definition, so it's not only just state lands, but it's improvements to that land. We found that we have several locations where we actually have state buildings constructed with state funds that are on leased land. And we would like to have the opportunity to sell a building that is on leased property and feel that the chapter needs to be slightly adjusted with the word improvements in order to do that. Secondly, general authority for construction. Once again, you'll recall that we do have our own authority for design and construction of capital projects. There's a little confusion in the statute in the sense that one part of the statute says that if a project is over $50,000, that we should notify the legislature if it's funded by state appropriation or operating appropriation or institutional receipts. Another part of the same statute says that notification is only necessary if it's over $3 million, and that's in the case of revenue-producing facilities such as res halls. And what we'd like to do for consistency is to have the notification level increase to $3 million for any kind of capital project, regardless of the funding source. The third one, increase the revenue fund bonding authority from $150 million to $250 million. You may recall that the Minsky Revenue Fund can sell bonds to support capital projects only at the seven state universities. And the revenue fund is only for those revenue-producing buildings at state universities, res halls, the student unions, parking ramps, and athletic and wellness centers where there are fees to support its operation. The current debt limit in statute in the revenue fund is $150 million, and the current debt of the revenue fund is about $120 million. Now, there are two projects that we are slated for June of 2008 for selling our revenue bonds, both at Winona State, $7 million for Memorial Hall and $43 million for a new residence hall. And so we need to raise the debt limit to accommodate these two projects. And then we have almost $100 million in planning, in future planning at our state universities for other projects, probably in the 09 to 10 time frame. And so we'd like to raise that limit to $250 million now to cover the current need as well as the near-term need that we can, as we see it. As state university students are always consulted before the board will approve these bond sales, since the students pay the full cost of these projects. And you'll be hearing from MSUSA shortly on this one. A little bit of a cough, excuse me. The fourth item is to add Owatonna as a named campus. 136F outlines or very specific about where our campuses are located, and if you support the acquisition of the Owatonna College and University Center, then we would ask that the statute be amended to include its name as a campus location, permanent location. And then finally, in Chapter 16A, we would ask that a new subdivision be added for authorization to convert capital dollars to HEPR dollars once the capital project is completed. If you remember, in the last several bonding bills, there's been a session law provision that allows conversion of any unspent HEPR authorization, any unspent project authorization to HEPR at the same campus. And what we're simply asking for here is to codify that provision so we know for a certainty that it's there.
Mr. Johnson, is it your intention to pursue these items in the capital investment bill or in a separate, in our policy bill? Are there any that have to be in the capital investment bill?
Well, Madam Chair, we were pursuing this certainly through the capital bill because so much of this, all of it, relates to facilities, and so we expected it would ultimately be in the bonding bill. We would certainly ask your support as a policy matter from your committee to move it forward, however you ultimately move your recommendations forward.
Well, I don't think adding Owatonna as a named campus location needs to be in the bonding bill. And I would like to have some more discussion about that. Are you starting a new college? Is that what you're doing?
Madam Chair, what we would do would be to make it a permanent location. As I said, we have delivered programs in Owatonna for many years in rental spaces.
And it's connection with a certain college down there?
With
Riverland,
Austin and Albert Lea and Owatonna. It would be under the stewardship of Riverland.
Okay.
But it would have supporting programs or would be supported from our other colleges and universities in that sector, MSU, Mankato, South Central College, the two that come to mind.
Would also offer
programs there. Yes. Madam Chair, with that, that concludes my overview. And unless there are questions now, or if you would like to shift.
Are there any questions from members of the committee, Senator Tomassoni?
Sure. Mr. Johnson, of the $155 million that you said is they're ready to go, I think you said there were 16 projects. Are they 16, the first 16, or are they spread out? Or is that part of HEPA also?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni, they are not the first 16. There are 16 that were authorized last time as a total. Mm-hmm. These are about, I think there's a dozen or so. They are not all ready to go instantaneously. They're within the next 12 months. And I can get you that list and show you which ones they are.
Does it get down to number 19?
Yes.
Answer.
It will.
Yeah, because it's
any other questions? Then I'd like to bring up the panel. Oh, Senator Roebling.
I have a question. We have the land acquisition and the demolition, and I always wonder about the property acquisition, and sometimes it's necessary for expanding campuses. And I'm looking at the list here of campuses where they want to acquire property. It's number 28. And I think, I don't know if their student populations are growing, if we expect continued growth there. I look at Bemidji, they want to acquire property from the old high school, but then I look over here and across the next page, and it says that they're going to demolish a big building, which obviously is going to open up additional space. I just wonder about the need to acquire some of this additional land.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. The need for additional property, it comes in a couple of ways. One is looking at the master plan for each of the college and universities and what's on their boundaries. Are there opportunities to protect their boundaries so we don't have encroachment that prevents that future growth? I think Fond du Lac is a good example of that, where we have a very compact, tight college footprint, and the community is right up to the edge. And, in fact, we've had some problems in the community with growth, physical growth of that campus. At Bemidji, this is the this property has been in our request for several years. It's the only public property, it's formerly the high school, that's available near the university for expansion purposes, for parking in the near term, without having to go into the residential community. And so it varies. Some of the other acquisitions, at Minnesota State University Moorhead, which is proposing the Edison School. This is a site off campus which has been used, is being used, in conjunction with Minnesota State Community and Technical College Moorhead for joint programming. And it was a location where the two schools could come together and deliver programs at one central location in the community. So I think it's a variety of reasons, a lot of it affecting the campus boundary, some the delivery of programs, some for future expansion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I still am concerned that, we know that our high school graduate numbers will peak, I think, next year, and then we're going to start going down. And one of our goals is to get more students, a higher percentage of those graduates, into higher education. But as far as expansion, I don't know that we should be looking at that a great deal now. We maybe need to put more money into getting those students into the programs, because we have a lot of facilities already available, and I don't want them to be underutilized. And so I think that we need to really be careful. I mean, we can do some replacements, renovations, but adding space at this point maybe doesn't, except in critical areas where population growth has been tremendous. We have to balance this out somehow, and I'm concerned that everybody gets their turn at getting a new building or some repair, but I think we often need to focus on those areas where there's highest demand and where the facilities are currently being well utilized. And I don't know if the day will come, Senator Pappas, where we might have to close some facilities if the population of students going on to higher education declines, or if online enrollment grows so much that we need fewer facilities. You know, things are changing in our world today, and I sometimes have concerns that we may be doing things the traditional way and not looking at the new things that may be coming down the road.
Thank you for those comments. Before we bring up our panel, I just wanted to invite Senator Erickson Ropes to the table. I know she wants to say some cheerleader words for the Minsky project in her district. And Senator
Thank
Kubley,
you, Madam Chair.
Just a minute. Senator Kubley, I think I had announced before, if you didn't have anyone from out of town, we might have to carry over your bill until the next meeting. Because the session starting at 2:30, we're going to probably run out of time.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
okay. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's been a long time, Senator, since somebody called me a cheerleader. But I am here just to remind you about the great project down in the Winona area and that is on Minsky's list, although I don't think you heard about it today, but it's the Integrated Wellness Complex. And I'm very excited about it because this project really is ready to go, and it fits really seamlessly in with the whole direction that the healthcare committees are looking at going. We're trying to move away from a sickness model, and we're trying to contain costs, and we're trying to integrate healthcare and move towards wellness. And that's exactly what this Integrated Wellness Complex accomplishes. It is going to be one building that combines health services, counseling, fitness, nutrition, and academic experiences for the students all in one building. I'm very excited about it because it's going to help, I think, with the overall state's objective of trying to move our population to a healthier place. Both the governor and the legislature currently right now are looking at statewide health improvement strategies. And this is a perfect example of how we can get one off the ground and started in southeastern Minnesota. And again, I would just, without getting into a lot of detail and information, I have packets to be presented to the committee later on. But this really pushes integrating educational opportunities for the students to learn in one classroom, walk across the hall, work with members of the community to do cardiac rehab in the same building. Another thing that I've been very concerned about recently, and I know Senator Sharon in her district has had a student death this last fall due to alcohol poisoning. I've had a student in my community die of the same thing. This would have opportunities in this building to deal with student counseling, alcohol and tobacco, addictions, dealing with all that in terms of wellness. So we're not separating off mental health issues into one area. Everything's together in one spot. One of the most exciting things about this offer is that we already have $3 million in private donations from the Winona area that have been collected and designated to support this project. And the students are absolutely behind this project. The bulk of the funding comes from student fees. And then that would greatly leverage between the student fees and the private donations. So it would greatly leverage the state's money. So it seems to me to be a great package. It puts us on the course to 21st century health care and wellness care for the whole state. So I would encourage the members to look favorably at this proposal.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming by.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to invite the students and faculty groups to all come up together, maybe just pull a couple extra chairs up. So we have five chairs up there. And we have to We have to adjourn at 2:30, so we have about 10 minutes for the panel. Chancellor, did you have any other comments you were going to make? The panel, right. Okay. Welcome. If you can just state your name when you give your comments.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Kara Brockett. I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I'm currently a student down at Southwest State University. First and foremost, I just want to say that MSUSA supports the 2008 capital budget request of $272.9 million for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. This includes projects at each state university as well as much-needed funding for repair and restoration of the structures throughout the system. I'd like to just reiterate that we believe that it is essential to the safety and health of our students that we continue to move forward in the repair and restoration of our institutions. An additional $110 million in HEPR funding would mean that every Minskew campus will receive funds and help eliminate the backlog of more than $650 million in campus needs across the system, and it would also create jobs within the communities that our institutions exist in. Yeah. I'd also like to quickly address the students' concerns about the debt services. When campuses build new structures, two-thirds of the funding comes from the state, and the other one-third of the funding must be provided by the system and individual colleges and universities. As a result, campuses must dip into their budgets or raise tuition to cover some of the costs, placing an additional burden on students. Higher education is the only state entity that must provide one-third of the funding for new buildings, and we would like to see the state contribute a higher proportion of the debt service. Finally, I'd like to mention the proposed increase in bonding authority for the revenue fund, which funds student unions, residence halls, and other non-academic buildings and structures on our campuses. Students support the proposed increase in bonding authority. Their fees pay for these buildings, and there's extensive consultation on our campuses regarding the building and updating these structures. Though my comments are brief, I'd like to also note that we have provided written copies of our memo that addresses these concerns in much more depth, and I'm open for any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brockett. Any questions? Okay, next. Mr. Formo.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Scott Formo, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. In light of time this afternoon, I'm going to make my comments very brief. There was a memo that was passed out to everybody, and I would, although a lot of our positions are very similar to the university students, there are some differences, so I'd encourage you to read through the memo. But just to highlight the three main priorities for you, we do support the capital bond request that's been brought forth by the Minsky Board of Trustees and the Office of the Chancellor, with HEPR being our highest priority. And then secondly, I'd just like to point out that we are supportive of the codification of the Minnesota statute to allow that the unused portion of capital bonding money to be able to be used on campuses for HEPR projects. And with that being said, I'd gladly stand for any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Pappas and honorable members of the Senate. My name is Karen Foreman, and I'm president of the AFSCME Minskew Policy Committee. AFSCME employees in Minskew represent the carpenters, the clericals, the general maintenance workers, groundskeepers, plumbers, security patrol officers. We're the frontline staff of Minskew. We unlock the doors in the morning. We answer the phones all day long. We clean and repair the facilities. We know these campuses inside out. We know them from the tunnels in the bottom to the rooftops because we repair them. We work on them. And AFSCME workers work very hard to keep the equipment and building running in as good a condition as possible, given the age of the buildings and the limited HEPR funding in the last two biennials. I should also point out that we do this with less people, even though there are more students on the campuses. In 2001, AFSCME had 3,900 employees in Minskew, and as of September of 2007, we have 3,700 people, but there are, you know, more students, more square footage for us to take care of. So I think that speaks to the efficiency of the system. AFSCME has a great deal of respect for the professionalism and the quality of work that's done by the Officer of the Chancellor in putting this proposal together. Many of the major proposals also go toward the HEPR work to renew our buildings. So we're very supportive of this. And basically, Minskew's ready to go on these projects. Minsky has a good record for starting the projects, getting them done. Given the state of the economy, I think that would be a very valuable thing for us to have right now. Minsky projects are located all over the state, so this is a boost to all areas of the state. And basically, AFSCME and the AFL-CIO want you to know that we're very supportive of the projects as they have been proposed by Minsky. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Foreman. Dr. Black.
Good afternoon, Chair Pappas and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Black, president of the Interfaculty Organization, or IFO, which represents more than 3,600 faculty at the seven state universities. The people I represent are the people who teach in the buildings that you authorize, often for 30 or 35 years. So we have a very strong issue and this strong interest in this issue. The IFO supports the Minsky bonding request. We also support the prioritization of projects in the Minsky bonding proposal, and we hope that you will honor these priorities. We especially support the higher education asset preservation and repair request. We are the people who have to try and teach in classrooms on a hot day when the air conditioning system isn't working, or who have to teach among the leaks and stained ceiling tiles when a roof fails or the ceiling falls in, and they do. And I was particularly touched by the testimony of the disabled University of Minnesota representative today, because we too have ADA very serious issues which impair student learning in terms of their access and the facilities. HEPR funding may not be as exciting as building a new building, but as the current bridge crisis demonstrates, maintaining our existing infrastructure is usually the most cost-effective investment, and it should be our highest priority. The IFO also supports an increase in the gas tax. While that may not seem like it's related to higher education buildings, it most certainly is this year. $416 million of the governor's bonding request is for transportation. While we support more money for roads, and I live within walking distance of that bridge that fell down and was on it that day, we believe that it is going to squeeze out other bonding priorities, especially higher education. The governor is only supporting $40 million of Minsky's $110 million request for HEPR, and only supporting seven of the 37 projects requested by Minsky. We hope that you will cover the cost of transportation through a gas tax increase and fund more higher education facilities through the bonding bill. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the faculty, and I stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Then Mr. Ama.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Shahzad Ahmad, and I'm the president of MUSAF, which stands for Minnesota State University Association of Administrative and Service Faculty. I'm here to represent over 600 members from seven state universities. I'm also here to support the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities capital budget request. We are in need of new and renovated facilities to benefit the students at our state universities and colleges. Also, the request for major repair and replacement funding is vital to our system. We believe that provision of funds for many of the projects as outlined in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities capital budget request directly benefit the health, energy efficiency, and overall safety of the campuses that directly impacts all students, faculty, staff, and public. We are proud of our state for making an investment in higher education system that provides access and opportunity to quality higher education. It is also our responsibility to make investment in this system to keep the infrastructure strong and modern that is competitive and conducive to an environment of learning for our future generations. I thank you for your time and your service to the great state of Minnesota.
Great. Is that...